That's a great story. I think it tops anything that I've seen watching the court the past couple of years, though watching Justice Scalia and the Chief Justice lately in action has been pretty close. So I'll say that. What I want to do with my time with you today is to just try to talk a little bit about this term of the court, which, of course, we're very much in the midst of. In fact, arguments will be starting for the last session of the court's term just on Monday, and they'll be hearing cases for the next 2 weeks. So it's a bit premature to be doing a postmortem on the term or discussing, you know, what are the major themes of this term in the court. Nonetheless, I'm here in April, so I will make a few observations about some of the most important cases that the court has already decided and also some of the more interesting cases that either have been argued and will be decided before the end of June or one or two of the cases that will be argued. Even in the best of circumstances, trying to talk about the court in the middle of the term is a hazardous enterprise because, of course, you know, generally you just don't know what are going to be some of the major decisions of the term at this point. And this year, it's probably more difficult than normal because at this point, the court seems to be a little bit behind schedule in terms of issuing its opinions. Last year, at this time of the term, at this juncture, the court had issued 35 opinions. Right now, this term, the court has issued only 22. So they're a good measure behind the pace of last year. And last year, if you'll remember, was actually a fairly disruptive term where things were a little slow anyways because you had the unusual spectacle of Justice O'Connor coming in for the beginning part of the term and then leaving in February with Justice Alito arriving, which also required some cases to be reargued. So I think it's fair to say that the court is a little bit behind the pace where they would normally be at this time in a court term. To add to matters, I think it's also true that the arguments this term have actually been a little bit back-weighted. And what I mean by that is that the court, in a rather unusual situation earlier in the year, was having a little bit of trouble actually filling out the court's normal docket. I mean, as a general matter, you sort of assume, at least over the last, say, 7 to 10 years, that the court's going to take between 70 to 80 cases on the merits. And what that's going to mean is that the court, on every argument day, will hear 2 cases a day. And so if they have a full calendar and they don't have any holidays or anything like that, you'd expect them to hear about 12 cases a month. This year, they were sufficiently behind the pace that they would like to have that they had to cancel a day of argument in December, which is relatively unprecedented in recent memory. And then in the February and March sittings in the spring, the court actually had to have a number of days where they only heard 1 argument a day. And so they only heard something like 7 cases in the February sitting. And so on 3 of the 5 days, they only heard 1 argument in those days. And so, too, in March, on 4 of the 6 argument days, they only heard a single argument. The court is making up for lost time in April because the court will actually have 16 cases on the April calendar, which means they'll be hearing some cases in the afternoon, which used to be commonplace, but it's become a relatively unusual practice. What this all means is that this term, even more than most, is going to be one where a lot of the important decisions come by at the end of the term, or issued at the end of the term. And I think anybody who's clerked on the court has always kind of thinks back as May and June as being a particularly unpleasant time of the year because there's so much going on in terms of getting the opinions out in relatively short order. And that's going to be even more difficult this year with a larger number than usual of April cases to try to get out. So those are the challenges one faces in trying to talk about this particular term at midterm because I think quite a bit still remains to be seen in terms of the argued cases and certainly when it comes to the decided cases. That said, let me talk about a couple of the cases that have been decided and I think are quite interesting and already suggest that this is going to be a fairly interesting term, both as a general matter, but also in terms of revealing something about what the Roberts Court is going to look like in this, its first year together as a new court with Justice Alito as a full member of the court for the full term. Probably the most significant case that the court has issued so far this term is the Massachusetts against EPA case, the so-called greenhouse gases case. And I say so-called, not because I'm trying to take issue with the science of greenhouse gases, but mostly because this case, like many an important environmental case, is every bit as much a standing case as it is a substantive environmental law case. It is, in fact, both. But it may be that a few years from now, as important as this case is as a matter of substantive environmental law, it may be even more important as a matter of Article III standing law. There were three issues in this case as it came to the court. There was the issue of whether anybody had standing to challenge the EPA's refusal or declination to issue regulations on the whole issue of greenhouse gases. There was also the statutory construction question of whether or not the EPA, in fact, had the authority to regulate greenhouse gases. And then the third issue was, even if the EPA had that authority, did they have the discretion effectively not to exercise the authority in this particular context? Now, as I mentioned, the court did issue a very important standing decision as part of its disposition of this case. And, of course, it found that there was standing for the state of Massachusetts to bring this challenge to the EPA's failure to promulgate a rule. And it's a very interesting development because the court effectively conceded that there were some at least difficult Article III standing questions in the case. Effectively said that, of course, we only need one litigant with standing in a case, and so we're going to focus in on the state of Massachusetts as opposed to the environmental plaintiffs who actually got this litigation off and running. And the court effectively suggested that there would be special principles of standing that would make it easier for a state to establish standing than it would be for a private litigant. And this is an interesting development largely because it's unprecedented. I think the majority opinion, you know, acknowledged the fact that it really didn't have much in the way of precedent to cite for this notion that states have a better claim to Article III standing than private litigants. And, of course, the Chief Justice in dissent was quite adamant that this was a novel development and one that was did not have an adequate basis in the Article III standing principles. Whatever this decision suggests in the future, I certainly think it is one that for the first time sort of creates a different set of standing principles for state governments. It's not clear exactly what the difference is. I mean, I think it's if you look at the majority opinion, the court sort of suggests they're a plus factor for the state, but it doesn't go beyond that in terms of explaining exactly how that plus factor will work in other cases. It's interesting to me because in watching the argument in this case, one of my reactions was that one of the difficulties that some of the justices, and in particular Justice Kennedy, was having is that in a case that involves something like greenhouse gases, which at some level or another affects almost everyone, I think he had some discomfort in the notion that either everyone could sue or that no one could sue. And, of course, this novel decision, which recognizes that, well, somebody can sue, not necessarily everybody, but at least the state of Massachusetts can sue, at least is responsive to that set of concerns. On the merits, of course, the court found both that the EPA had the statutory authority to regulate greenhouse gases and that the EPA's stated reasons for not exercising that authority in this case were inadequate. What the court stopped short of holding is that the EPA absolutely must regulate greenhouse gases going forward. But in a sense, what the court said is that if the EPA is going to make that decision, it's going to have to squarely say that it finds the science of greenhouse gases such that it cannot make a finding that there is a cause of air pollution from greenhouse gases. And that's something that the EPA didn't do in this particular case, and I think that would probably be a relatively difficult thing for the finding for the EPA to make. But what, again, I think one important thing is that the court did stop short of specifically saying that the EPA must regulate in this area. One other thing, of course, to note about the decision is that it was a closely divided decision, 5-4, with Justice Kennedy providing, in a sense, the fifth vote in that the other justices aligned, as one might suspect in a case like this, both on standing and the merits, in that Justice Stevens wrote the court's opinion, joined also by Justices Breyer, Souter, and Ginsburg, as well as Justice Kennedy. And I think that this case, especially when read together with the Rapanos case from last term, which involved the jurisdictional reach of the Clean Water Act, It very much suggests in the Rapanos case, Justice Kennedy also provided the critical fifth vote for a broader scheme for the federal regulation of waters. And I think together these two cases suggest that Justice Kennedy, at least in the environmental context, very much holds the fifth vote in these areas. On the same day the court decided the greenhouse gases case, it also decided a Duke Energy case involving a different issue under the Clean Air Act. And I think in that case the court did show that it is possible to decide an environmental case other than 5-4. Indeed, the court in this case achieved almost full consensus. The decision was basically 8-1 with Justice Thomas concurring in the result. This case involved two related questions. One was a jurisdictional question about, in a challenge to a rule, can you bring a challenge that would have the effect of invalidating a major federal rule in a regional court of appeals, here the Fourth Circuit, or must that challenge take place in the D.C. Circuit? There was also an important statutory construction question, which, if you sort of abstract away for a second from the specific context of the issue of the Clean Air Act, the question before the court was essentially whether or not when Congress uses basically the same term in two closely related statutory provisions, does an agency have the flexibility to interpret the term differently in the two contexts? And if you think about this in terms of Chevron analysis, if a term in a statute is sufficiently ambiguous that normally you defer to the agency's construction, does the agency lose its claim to deference if they interpret the word differently, both ways within the range of reasonable constructions, but differently in two closely related contexts? The Fourth Circuit had effectively said that you must interpret the word the same way in both contexts, and the Supreme Court, as I say, in a near unanimous decision by Justice Souter, reversed that decision and said that there really was enough flexibility in this area and more generally for an agency to construe a term to have different meanings as long as both constructions were reasonable in light of the statutory structure. The court essentially ducked for a definitive resolution of the jurisdictional issue and set the case back to the Fourth Circuit on that question. Let me talk about briefly two other environmental cases that are going to be argued in the next couple of weeks. And before I do so, let me just say that if you put these two cases that will be argued together with the greenhouse gases case and the Duke Energy case, I think this court's term will probably be remembered as being one of the most interesting terms in terms of environmental law that the court has had in a long time, because there really are, I think, four cases of some significance in the environmental law area this term. The other two I should mention that are coming up. One, the one that will be argued just next week, is a case called National Association of Home Builders against Defenders of Wildlife. And this case really involves a potential conflict or an effort to reconcile two of the most important statutes in the environmental law area, one being the Clean Water Act, the other being the Endangered Species Act. And the specific question in this case deals with part of the Clean Water Act in which the EPA can, if a state meets certain criteria, and the statute specifies 9 criteria, the EPA, if the state meets those 9 criteria, must, the statutory phrase, must give the permitting authority over to the state. So you can think of this provision as being something of an effort in cooperative federalism where the EPA gets regulatory authority over waters within a state, but the state can effectively take that over if it satisfies certain conditions. In this context, then, the question is, are those 9 factors that are set out in the statute basically exclusive, or does the Endangered Species Act, rather, come in and effectively impose a 10th condition and require the federal government, before it turns over the permitting authority to the states, to also make a determination that turning the permitting authority over to the states will not have an effect of jeopardizing any listed species? And so it's really, I think, at bottom a question of does the Endangered Species Act effectively trump the Clean Water Act and add an additional criteria, or does the Clean Water Act, by specifying 9 and only 9 criteria before authorities turned over this state, basically occupy the field and not allow the Endangered Species Act to come in and impose additional conditions? That question alone in that context is important enough, I think, but this case, at least depending on how the court decides it, has the potential to even address a broader question of how does the Endangered Species Act apply in situations where statutes impose what seems like a mandatory duty on federal regulators, as opposed to when the federal statute imposes a discretionary duty on the federal regulators. Because the Endangered Species Act, the way it works, this provision, is it basically forces agencies, before they take any major action, to make a determination that that action will not jeopardize a listed endangered species. And the question is, when another act of Congress tells you that you must do certain things in certain areas, if certain conditions are met, does that end the matter, or do you also have to make a determination under the Endangered Species Act? The last of the environmental cases I should mention is one that I think is of particular importance to the business community because it involves the CERCLA statute and particularly involves how the costs of recovering a Superfund site will be apportioned among the potentially responsible parties. The case is United States against Atlantic Research, and the question is essentially when a potentially responsible person, so somebody who has some responsibility for a site that needs to be cleaned up, if that person does the cleanup voluntarily, can they get contribution rights from other people who might have contributed to the site? So a classic example would be a current owner who's not a completely innocent owner but nonetheless wants to take the initiative in cleaning up the site. Can they do that and then sue perhaps the prior owner who contributed to the pollution? Can they go ahead and sue that prior owner for contribution? The Supreme Court, in a case about 3 years ago called Cooper Industries, said that the major provision that people had relied on to get contribution in those circumstances did not provide a right to contribution in those circumstances, but they reserved the question of whether there might be some other way of getting that kind of contribution recovery. As is often the case, when the court reserves a question, it comes back a couple of years later, and that's what's happened here. As a practical matter, what the importance of this issue is really whether or not there will be an incentive for homeowners and owners of businesses to clean up voluntarily, or instead whether there will be a very big incentive for them to reach a voluntary agreement with the EPA, because if they do that, then there's clearly under the statute a right to recover from the other individuals that have contributed to the environmental problem. As I say, I think if you look at these four cases together, this will be a term that will be remembered as having some very important environmental cases. I also think this court's docket this year is pretty heavy on business cases, and I think that the business docket of the court will also be kind of a significant contributor to the importance of the decisions of this term. Of the decided cases in this area, the one that I think has gotten the most attention is the one involving punitive damages, the Philip Morris against Williams case, where the court, in a 5-4 decision, effectively invalidated an $80 million punitive damages award that was issued by the state courts in Oregon. As the case came to the Supreme Court, there were really two important issues for the court in applying the B&W against Gore line of cases. And those cases are really where the court, for the first time, imposed limits on punitive damages award through the Due Process Clause. And the two questions that the court had to face were, first of all, how to reconcile two competing aspects, at least competing in this case, of the analysis. The B&W against Gore case said that there are a couple of guideposts that courts should look at in reviewing punitive damages awards, and two of the most important ones were the reprehensibility of the conduct involved and the ratio of punitive damages to compensatory damages. And there had been some suggestion in the court's subsequent cases that anything more than about a 10-to-1 ratio of punitives to compensatory damages would be a hard award to survive appellate review under the Due Process Clause. In the context of this particular case, these two principles were kind of at odds because you had a tobacco context where there was a very strong argument that the conduct was in fact quite reprehensible, but on the other hand, the ratio of damages to punitive damages to compensatory damages was quite significant. A lot of the focus on the case was on that issue. Court ultimately didn't decide it. It decided only a second issue in the case, which was the extent to which the punitive damages award can punish the defendant not just for what it did to the plaintiff in the case, but also what it did to third parties who are not before the court. And on this issue, the court drew what I think, in fairness, is something of a difficult distinction. What the court held is that it is constitutional for the jury to take into account the injuries to third parties in determining how reprehensible the conduct is, but the jury cannot take the injuries to third parties into account strictly in punishing the defendant. And if you had a little trouble following that, you're probably not alone. It's a very, I think it is, in fairness, a very fine distinction. And I think that it's going to be interesting to see how courts in instructing juries are going to deal with this relatively fine line between third-party injuries are fine to consider when you're considering how reprehensible the conduct is, but when you get to the end of the analysis and want to decide how much punishment is appropriate, you can't take that into account. I think probably what you're likely to see is that a lot of juries will be instructed from the Supreme Court's opinion verbatim on the theory that that's the best way not to get reversed, and we'll just let the jury figure it out. I think that in some ways, because that distinction is pretty fine, the more important aspect of this decision is not so much what the court decided in this particular case. I think what's particularly interesting is the fact that both the Chief Justice and Justice Alito were in the majority in this case. And that is interesting because if you look at this area of the law, it's actually a pretty interesting area of the law in the sense that the court has divided on these issues and not divided in the way that you might expect at first blush. The B&W against Gore case that was the first one that recognized these procedural due process and substantive due process limits on punitive damages awards, that case was 5-4. The dissenters in that case were Justice Scalia, Justice Thomas, the Chief Justice Rehnquist, and Justice Ginsburg. And then in the State Farm case, it was 6-3, the dissenters this time being Justice Ginsburg, Justice Thomas, Justice Scalia. Now, those are not three justices you'd necessarily would think would be in lockstep on this issue. In fact, they're not quite in lockstep because Justice Ginsburg has a slightly different take on the reason why the federal courts don't have a role here. But this is an issue where I don't think, given that constellation of justices, that you could confidently predict how any new justice was going to approach these cases. And I think you might in particular think that Justice Alito and the Chief Justice Roberts might have some attraction to the Scalia-Thomas view on this issue, which is essentially that the Due Process Clause has nothing to say about punitive damages awards and their amount. Punitive damages have been with us since the founding, and to the extent you're trying to find a substantive component to the Due Process Clause, good luck, I think, is essentially where Justice Scalia and Justice Thomas come out. And one would think that that analysis might have some attraction to Chief Justice Roberts and Justice Alito. And given the lineup, if that argument did find favor with them, you could find that B&W against Gore and State Farm would actually be reversed, and the court would get out of this business about 6 years after they first got into the business. That wasn't what happened, and both Justice Alito and the Chief Justice were in the majority, because Justice Stevens, who's normally in the majority in these cases, dissented on case-specific grounds. Both of their votes were critical to getting a five-justice majority for the decision in this case. So I do think that aspect of the decision is quite significant going forward and suggests that this kind of excessiveness review for punitive damages award will be a feature of Supreme Court jurisprudence for some while to come. Let me talk briefly about a couple of antitrust cases on the court's docket. I mean, I would do this because I think they're important cases, but also because there are four cases on the court's docket. And in recent history, that is an extraordinarily large number of antitrust cases. I'll talk about them just briefly, each one, and then make a couple of comments about how the cases sort of sort together and fit together. The case that was already decided was a case called Weyerhaeuser. It may be the least important of the four cases, though don't tell that to the Weyerhaeuser Corporation, because the effect of the decision was to reverse an $80 million treble damages award. The issue in the case was whether or not the same kind of limitations that the court imposed about a decade ago on predatory pricing claims would also be applied to predatory bidding claims, effectively where the situation is that somebody in a predatory fashion is buying up the resources necessary to produce a product. The reason I think the court in this case said that in a 9-0 decision reversing the Ninth Circuit, that the same kind of gateway factors that you have that make it relatively difficult to bring a predatory pricing claim also make it relatively difficult to bring a predatory bidding claim. The reason I don't think this case will be all that significant in the long run is until this case, I'm not sure most people had ever heard of a predatory buying or bidding claim, and I think after this decision they probably won't hear about one again. The one case that has been argued, I guess the other three cases have all been argued at this point. One involved a procedural issue, and therefore you might think that it is somehow less significant than a substantive antitrust case. But I do think the case, which is Bell Atlantic against Twombly, has the potential to be among the most significant of these antitrust cases as a practical matter, because it deals with the issue of what you have to plead in an antitrust case to get past the motion to dismiss stage. And you may have kind of come across this concept either in civil procedure or in antitrust class if you've taken it, but whether or not you've come across the principle yet, if you try your hand at private practice, you will quickly become very familiar with the dynamic of major litigation these days, which is it is critically important for defendants to try to get cases dismissed at the motion to dismiss stage, because the discovery process itself can be so costly and so burdensome that the pressures to settle a case, if you aren't successful at getting the case knocked out at the motion to dismiss stage, are so significant as a practical matter that many, many cases never get past the motion to dismiss stage. Either it's dismissed at that stage, or if it goes much further, the case ends up settling. So these standards are very important. They have particular importance in the antitrust context, and this is a Section 1 antitrust conspiracy allegation context, because if there's one thing that I think is standard fare in antitrust law, it is that parallel behavior among competitors, would-be competitors, even consciously parallel behavior in the absence of an agreement is not an antitrust violation. It's the way many major industries in the countries end up working. They just, you know, they're very conscious of how the other people are pricing their products. They price together in a way where they have conduct that, if you look at it, is parallel. And if that parallel conduct were the product of an agreement, it would be a clear Section 1 violation. But if it's not, it's not just not a clear violation, it's not a violation at all. So in that context, the question before the court was, how do you deal with a complaint that is very long on allegations of parallel conduct, but is just conclusory when it says in basically one paragraph, and all that parallel conduct was the result of an unlawful agreement? And the question essentially is that enough to get you to discovery, or do you need to do more? And if so, what more do you need to plead? The other antitrust cases, one that was argued, last month, raises actually a somewhat similar question. It's a case about the potential conflicts between the securities laws and the antitrust laws, particularly in the context of the underwriting process for initial public offerings. And as many of you may be aware, there was a spate of IPOs in the late 90s up to about 2000 that basically took off like rockets, at least in the first couple of days. Everybody was making lots of money. Times were good. A lot of those IPOs aren't worth a terrible amount now, and there's been a lot of litigation that's been generated as a result. A lot of that litigation was securities litigation, but things like the PLSRA, which is the Private Securities Litigation Reform Act, and the like have made it harder to bring those kind of cases as securities cases, and a lot of these cases have now been kind of resurrected as antitrust claims. And they again raise this issue about something where it's very easy to plead a conspiracy. Here it's particularly easy because the way that an IPO syndicate is put together involves lots of collaborative conduct among otherwise competitive investment banks, and all of that collaborative conduct is sanctioned by the SEC. It's all perfectly permissible, but there are some things that a syndicate can do that violates the SEC rules, and in any event, it becomes very easy to allege an antitrust conspiracy, because you can really allege that all of them got together in a smoke-filled room, because indeed the SEC allows them to get together in a smoke-filled room. And the question of how to deal with that kind of issue and what has to be pled in those cases is before the court in this Credit Suisse case. The last case involves the antitrust rule involving resale price maintenance, and particularly vertical resale price maintenance agreements. These have been per se unlawful under the Sherman Act since 1911, when the court issued a case called Dr. Miles. Dr. Miles has been criticized by economists and lawyers since about 1912. But nonetheless, there it was as part of the court's jurisprudence, and the court in a number of other areas over the past 20 years has reversed and overruled cases involving per se rules in vertical arrangements and has moved from a per se rule to a rule of reason analysis. The court granted this case, and at the point that it granted it, it seemed pretty clear that the court would potentially overrule the Dr. Miles case. There was, after all, since this has been the rule since 1911, not much point to take the case if they weren't going to overturn it. It was interesting, though, because the argument in this case showed the court was very closely divided, and they may, in fact, end up overruling Dr. Miles, but if they do, I think it will be by a relatively narrow margin, and it'll be very interesting to watch this case. The last thing I will say is the fact that the court took four antitrust cases is a lot more than they have for a while. Very interesting. Last term they took three cases, which again was higher than usual. Last year in the three cases that the court considered on the merits, there were 27 votes in the three cases for the antitrust defendants and two for the antitrust plaintiffs. And the one case that's been decided this term so far was a 9-0 victory for the defendant in the Supreme Court. And if you look at the three other cases that have been argued but not decided, all of them were granted on the antitrust defendant's petition for certiorari, which, all things being equal, tends to suggest that the court may be interested in reversing in those cases as well. And I think if you read these cases together, especially depending on how the undecided cases come out, I think it may suggest that the court's basic orientation in these antitrust cases is to be on the lookout for cases in which perhaps the lower courts have made it a little too easy for the antitrust plaintiffs to complain or, as I say, at least get past the motion to dismiss stage. At the risk of really putting people to sleep, let me mention just briefly the fact that the court has a bunch of patent cases on the court's docket. And, again, this is maybe one of those things that it's harder to appreciate as a law student, easier to appreciate in private practice because there's a lot of money in them patents. And, indeed, intellectual property now reflects a great deal of the nation's, kind of economic growth potential. Whether it's because there's so much money in those patents and it represents such a substantial portion of the kind of nation's kind of gross product at this point, or for some other reason, I'll just, without getting into the details of this case, I will say that it is a very marked trend over the past couple of terms that the court has become very interested in taking patent cases. And it took at least three patent cases this term, including one that was very important. It involves the obviousness doctrine in patents. It's important because it's a threshold that every patent has to cross in order for the patent to be issued. I mean, you cannot get a patent on an idea that is obvious. So in every case, one of the requirements that you have to show before the PTO and the patent examiners is that the idea is non-obvious, and then if that's challenged after the fact, the courts have to deal with that question. Now, the point I want to make about this is not anything about substantive patent law, but to simply make the point that what I think is interesting here is that for about 25 years now, the Federal Circuit has had exclusive jurisdiction over patent cases. And for about the first 20 of those 25 years or so, the Supreme Court seemed pretty content to just let the Federal Circuit deal with these issues and really only very rarely took a patent case to review for itself. I think over the past couple of years, they've gotten more interested in this area, and I think they've also been somewhat skeptical of the approach that the Federal Circuit has taken on some of these issues. And again, without getting into the kind of the guts and the merits of the issue in this case involving obviousness, here's a hugely important issue where the Federal Circuit's test would have governed every patent issued in the country. And one justice memorably described the Federal Circuit's governing test as gobbledygook. And it wasn't a lot of sympathy for the Federal Circuit in the argument in the case among the justices, so much so that the chief judge of the Federal Circuit ended up issuing kind of a press release defending the Federal Circuit, which I think everybody sort of thought was pretty unprecedented for that to happen. And I think it's worth thinking about this issue just briefly because it's a very interesting kind of broader question because usually the way the court decides to take cases is they let the regional courts of appeals deal with the issues at a point where they divide and decide the issue differently, they take the case up. You can't do that with patent issues because the Federal Circuit is now the only court of appeals with jurisdiction. And if you allow that court to basically be the final court of review for patents, that creates certain expectations in the community. It requires the patent office, when it's approving initial patent applications, to deal with that body of law. And if all of a sudden now the Supreme Court kind of parachutes itself in and starts reviewing those cases, I mean, it has to, I think, you know, it creates an interesting dynamic because the court presumably will approach the issues essentially as a matter of first impression and decide what it thinks is right, but it has to deal with the fact that on at least some of these issues, there's about 20 years of kind of overhang of expectations that are at issue in some of these cases as well. I think you'll be glad to hear that I'll move off the patent topic now. What I will say in closing about the business cases, though, is that at the time that Chief Justice Roberts was confirmed, there was a lot of talk about his interest, and I think he even said something to this effect at his confirmation hearing, about increasing the court's docket. And as I alluded to at the outset, he really hasn't done that if you look at the numbers as a general matter. But I also think another kind of notion that was out there, though I'm not sure you could trace this to anything the Chief Justice said at his confirmation hearing, is that this is a lawyer, the Chief Justice, as a lawyer who represented a lot of businesses and might be sympathetic to the notion that there were important cases from the business community that needed to be addressed by the court. I do think if you look at this term, and it may just be happenstance, but it does seem like it's a particularly rich term in terms of business cases. And I also think if you look at kind of the practical dilemmas that private defendant companies, major corporations face, there's really three ways a corporate defendant can get itself into a lot of trouble. One is punitive damages, one is treble damages, and one is a class action. Those are devices that can get the numbers at issue to a point where you're getting not only the general counsel's attention but the CEO's attention. And I think it's maybe no accident that the court took on two of those three issues in getting involved in some of the antitrust cases, treble damages, and also taking on the punitive damages case. So maybe class actions are on the horizon. Let me talk briefly. I want to leave a couple of minutes for questions, but let me talk briefly about some other areas of the court docket. Here I'll be talking almost exclusively about cases that the court hasn't yet decided. In the criminal docket, I was an important part of the court's docket. And a lot of these cases, there's certainly been, the court's taken a number of cases this term dealing with various aspects of how the death penalty is administered. That's an issue where I won't talk as much about because for a variety of reasons, those cases have not really involved issues that arise in the context of the federal death penalty. Therefore, the federal government hasn't played much of a role, and I've been focused, to be quite honest, on some of the other issues. I will tell you this, that from the perspective of the federal government, it's not a close question as to what are the most important, practically speaking, cases on the court's criminal docket this term. They are quite clearly the court's sentencing cases, which are a follow-on to the Booker case. These are the cases of Rita and Claiborne, of the two cases. The court took them in tandem. They took them out of almost like a sea of petitions by various defendants trying to get the court's attention through cert petitions. The court themselves basically, you know, sorted through the sea of petitions and picked out these two cases, and the court framed the issue in these cases to really present two separate issues. In the Rita case, the question is, what do you do when a district court has sentenced a criminal defendant within a guidelines range? What level of review is there going to be in that case? Although that case is conceptually interesting, as a practical matter, I don't think that's the more important of the two cases. I think the really important case, certainly from the federal government's perspective, is the Claiborne case, because this involves what kind of review you can have in the courts of appeals if the district court sentences somebody significantly below the bottom of the guidelines range. And a number of circuits of appeals, including, I think, most notably the Eighth Circuit, have developed kind of a rule of thumb that an extraordinary departure from the guidelines range requires an extraordinarily good explanation for why the judge is departing downward. And the issue in this case, as it became framed before the Supreme Court, was essentially, does that more robust appellate review sort of recreate some of the Sixth Amendment problems that the court itself found problematic in Booker and led the court to invalidate the federal sentencing guidelines in the first place? And certainly from the argument, it's clear that at least some of the justices who were in the majority in the Apprendi, Blakely, Booker line of cases are quite concerned from a Sixth Amendment standpoint with any kind of appellate review that is sufficiently rigorous that it starts creating legal issues that would be for the judge and not the jury to decide. And I think if the court were to decide that this kind of robust appellate review of sentencing is not consistent with the Sixth Amendment, it really is going to create something of a quandary with the federal sentencing system, because the Sentencing Reform Act was introduced in the 80s largely as a response to the disparity in sentences. You could go into a courtroom, and in one federal courthouse, and in one courtroom, one judge was routinely giving light sentences, and the judge right next door was routinely giving very stern sentences. And so this whole legislative enactment was a response to that. And I think that would in large measure be reinstated if there isn't any kind of meaningful appellate review check. So I think that's a case that, from our standpoint, is quite important. And again, as I say, it really is kind of hard to compare with other cases because there are 1,200 criminal sentencings in the federal system each week, and the dynamic in every one of those, even though all of them won't be appealed, the dynamic in every one of those will be affected by the court's resolution of these cases. Let me talk about a couple of First Amendment cases on the court's docket. One is the Davenport against Washington Education Association case. This deals effectively with a competing reconciliation of the First Amendment rights of unions on the one hand and the First Amendment rights of union members who object to the union, or to be more precise about it, people who are in an agency shop arrangement and that they are forced by state law to either be in a union or pay union dues, but they don't actually want to sign up for the union. The court, in a long line of cases, has suggested that in the public employment context, where an individual is effectively forced to contribute to the union, the Constitution and the First Amendment give them a right to opt out of payment for non-germane issues, which is largely political activities of the union. The kind of principal case here is the Abood case. And some people in this area refer sort of knowingly and loosely to the Abood rights of the objecting members. And it's a right to opt out. If you raise your objection, you can have a refund of that portion of your dues. The state of Washington, as a matter of legislation, effectively turned that opt-out right to an opt-in right, and basically put the onus on the worker to affirmatively volunteer to pay the non-germane fees, and said to the unions, you can't even collect those fees until somebody has certified that they want to pay those fees. In this area, like many others, the laws of inertia work much more strongly than I guess I would have suspected, because the opt-in versus opt-out, I mean, makes a huge difference in the practical bottom line, which is why the lawsuit was worth litigating. The Washington State Supreme Court said that this opt-in arrangement actually violated the First Amendment rights of the union, and so you could not do this. The First Amendment basically requires you to have an opt-out right, and the Supreme Court took that case on review. I think it's fair to say that some of the justices seemed kind of skeptical that the states were in that kind of rock and a hard place where they had no flexibility to go from an opt-in regime to an opt-out regime or vice versa. The other major First Amendment case that is coming up at the end of the month will be the latest chapter in the campaign finance litigation before the court, particularly the litigation involving the McCain-Feingold or Bipartisan Campaign Reform Act. This case is called Wisconsin Right to Life against FEC. If you've been paying attention in this area of the law, that may sound familiar to you, because it is, because the same parties and basically the same case were before the court last term. This is all a follow-on to the McConnell litigation, in which the court largely upheld the Bipartisan Campaign Reform Act, including Title II, of the act, which put limitations on the abilities of corporations and unions to run certain kinds of ads within 60 days of an election targeted to the area where the election was ongoing. I think it's fair to say that the Congress's statute takes a fairly kind of bright-line prophylactic approach and says that if an ad meets four statutory criteria, then it has to be funded with PAC funds, not directly from the union treasury or the corporate treasury. I think that in many ways the court in McConnell, to the surprise of some, upheld that approach against an overbreath challenge, and now you have an as-applied challenge that follows on to that, where you have ads by this particular organization from an earlier Senate race that fit clearly within the statutory prohibition, but the argument is that these aren't really directed at the election. These are directed at legislative issues that are mentioned in the ads, and the question is, can those be swept in by the statutory broad prophylactic approach consistent with the First Amendment? And I think in some ways what makes this case quite intriguing is the change in the court's membership. I think that the court, if the same justices that had upheld the prophylactic approach of this statute were to face this particular as-applied challenge, I think there would be a good chance that the court would say that, no, this was within the degree of prophylaxis we approved in the McConnell case, and there may be a scope for as-applied challenges, but not of this type, not just based on the argument that your particular speech was issue-focused rather than election-focused. But with a change in the membership, not only could the court decide that the as-applied challenge has merit, but potentially the court could go quite a ways towards reconsidering the McConnell decision itself. Let me use that as a jumping-off point to talk about two other cases, or series of cases, I guess, or sets of cases, to be most accurate, that the court has had argument on and will be decided before the end of the term. And I think these are two cases that have broader levels of interest than, say, the patent docket. One set of cases involves the federal partial birth abortion statute. The other involves the use of race in school selection in the kind of K through 12 context. As I say, both of these cases have been argued, and I think, although the issues are obviously quite substantively different, there is a kernel of similarity in these cases in that both of these cases, I think, will be very influenced by a recent closely divided case of the Supreme Court. Starting with the partial birth abortion cases, these cases, of course, involve the federal statutory ban on the practice known as partial birth abortion, defined as partial birth abortion in the statute. It's hard to talk about a federal ban on this practice without thinking about, well, what about the states? And, oh, that's right, there was this Carhart case, Stenberg against Carhart, about 5 or 6 years ago, that in a closely divided 5-4 decision said that the state's ban on a very similar procedure, the definitions in the statute are a little bit different, but a similar procedure was unconstitutional. And so, of course, in the litigation of this case throughout in the lower courts and before the Supreme Court, the Stenberg decision looms large. The federal government, for its part, I mean, you know, gave most of its argument, a lot of emphasis on how the court could decide to uphold the statute without overturning the Stenberg decision. But at the end of the brief, the government argued in the alternative that if necessary to uphold the statute, then the court should revisit the Stenberg decision. I think that it's fair to say that from the argument, it's entirely unclear what the court will do. But this, whatever they do, I think that it will be both a decision that generates a lot of interest, and I think even beyond this particular context, will tell us something about how this court approaches precedent in stare decisis. I think something pretty similar could be said about the school assignment cases. In this case, the court had two separate cases in front of it, one involving the Seattle school system, the other involving the Louisville school system. But I think both can be fairly described as involving an effort by the local school board to keep the racial mix, the racial demographics of individual schools within a standard deviation or two of the overall racial demographics of the school district as a whole. In doing that, of course, there are certain schools that are more popular than others, more desirable, and so there are some people who are denied admission to those schools or denied access to those schools on the basis of race, and so it raises an equal protection clause issue. The court took these cases, and I think, again, here, one of the courts, or actually here, two of the court's prior precedents loom pretty large, and those are the Michigan affirmative action cases, the Grutter case involving the University of Michigan Law School, where the court upheld the use of race in admissions, and the Gratz case involving admissions at the undergraduate University of Michigan, where the court struck down the use of race. The major difference, I think it's fair to say, between Grutter and Gratz is the extent to which the use of race was relatively individualized versus more mechanical and used as kind of a broader proxy in the context of the undergraduate program. I mean, one way of thinking about these K through 12 programs is just to ask whether these cases are more like Grutter or more like Gratz. On the other hand, it may be that the court approaches these cases as really raising a fairly different issue than is raised in the post-secondary context. So it will be interesting to see. I think it's pretty unlikely that the court, no matter how it decides these cases, would reconsider Grutter or Gratz directly. But I think the way that the court treats those cases and deals with those cases, again, may tell us a fair amount about the court's approach, not just to this area, which is important enough in and of itself, but also its approach to stare decisis and precedent. So I think, although it's difficult to make any firm predictions in the middle of the term, I feel reasonably confident in predicting that the court's term as a whole will be considered quite an interesting and important one, and also that we will start to develop at least some meaningful data points when it comes to thinking about what the Roberts Court is going to look like and how they're going to deal, importantly, with this very interesting issue of stare decisis. Thanks.